Take that night train to Memphis. Take that night train to Memphis. And when you
Tennessee. It's a place in the heartland of America that's been chugging along since Tennessee was known as the Western Frontier. Today, Tennessee offers the visitor a fine mix of exploration options, from historic Revolutionary era and Civil War sites to hiking the Appalachian Trail. This is the place that's the home of Dolly Parton and Graceland, the place that's revered as the birthplace of American music and the Nashville sound. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Cindy Dupree, Tennessee Department of Tourist Development's Public Relations Director.
I love Tennessee, and I believe that we have some of the best tourism assets in the whole country, maybe some in the world. So it's an exciting job and something that I can really be passionate about and hopefully share this story with people all around the world.
Throughout Tennessee, from east to west, there's really diversity. There's a diverse range of cool things to see and do.
Yes, Tennessee is a very diverse state. On the west side of the state is the Great Mississippi River, and of course one of our major cities, Memphis, which is home of the blues and the birthplace of rock and roll, also the home of the late great Elvis Presley. His home Graceland is there, one of the most visited homes in America, as well as other great music attractions and the National Civil Rights Museum there, where Dr. King was assassinated, and they've built this great museum to honor him and honor that movement.
And the other fascinating thing is Tennessee is old Americana, going back to Revolutionary era. It's incredible, the roots. I'm from out west, where if something is 60 years old, it's like, wow, that's so old.
Well, we certainly have great history here, starting with the 7th President of the United States, Andrew Jackson, is from Tennessee, and there's his home right outside of Nashville that is the Hermitage. Great Old Hickory is his nickname. And so starting with that, even before that, of course, all the way through, there's the great Civil War history, great civil rights history. Now we're making new history here in Tennessee.
And going back to the Civil War era, Andrew Johnson.
We actually have the home of three presidents. Certainly, as I said, Andrew Jackson is the 7th, James K. Polk, 11th, and then Andrew Johnson, the 17th, right after Abraham Lincoln, and led us through the post-war era of the Civil War.
I visited his house, and that was really memorable. That was cool.
My name is Daniel Luther. I am a park guide at Andrew Johnson National Historic Site. We are about to give a tour of Andrew Johnson's 1851 homestead.
Daniel, tell us about this house that he and his family lived here, his wife.
That is correct. Johnson and his wife moved into this home in 1851 when he was still the 1st District Congressman in Tennessee. In the first 10 years he owned the home, Andrew Johnson moved from Congressman to Governor of Tennessee and then back to Congress in 1857 as a United States Senator.
When he was president at the end of the Civil War, was this still his home?
Yes. Andrew Johnson was the first vice president to take office on the assassination of his predecessor. They owned this home, but at the time they were not living in it.
But then subsequent to his presidency,
the Johnson family would have returned to this house by the end of March 1869. Mm-hmm. And when visitors come to our park today, this homestead in appearance is very much as it would have been in the period between 1869 and 1875, which is the last 6 years of Andrew Johnson's life.
The furniture that we see, the period pieces, what is original?
Throughout the home, 85% of all of the contents are original. The fact that the soldiers who occupied Johnson's home during and after the Civil War stole, damaged beyond repair, destroyed so many possessions meant that the Johnsons found it necessary to buy new furniture for their home before returning from the White House. What you see in the homestead largely comes from Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York.
Mm-hmm. And as some presidents leave the White House, they take some things with them. Did anything come from the White House?
Yes. Looking in Andrew Johnson's bedroom, which is the first room that we show visitors when they come to visit, there is a table, desk, You will find on it Andrew Johnson's signature stamp. But it was a sentimental purchase from the White House collection by President and Mrs. Johnson because their oldest grandson used the table in the White House for his schoolwork.
It meant a lot to them.
But knowing in part the criticism of Mrs. Lincoln, the Johnsons were very careful to make sure that the transaction was documented, that they had the receipt that they had purchased the piece.
In the trunk at the foot of the bed, that's original?
It's a canvas trunk stretched over a wooden frame. One of the interesting things about it is that Greenville, Johnson's hometown, is misspelled.
Oh, interesting.
Without the extra E in the middle.
Tell us a little bit more about the house.
The home visitors see today consists of 6 bedrooms, parlor, a dining room, and a kitchen. We show, obviously, that totals up to 9 rooms in Johnson's home that the public sees today. What they do see is far more of a family home than it is a home that was used for social activity. Not only were the Johnsons very frugal with their money, but Johnson's wife, Eliza, had tuberculosis during her adult life and did not enjoy or appreciate having a great deal of social activity going on around her. The Johnsons would be an example of a family who had money, but you wouldn't know it necessarily by the way they lived and conducted themselves. This park is open 7 days a week. We charge no fees. We are closed only on Thanksgiving Day, Christmas Day, and New Year's Day.
Daniel Luther, National Park Ranger, thank you so much. What a pleasure.
You are very welcome. It's delightful to have you guys here.
Yeah, right up in northeast Tennessee in Greenville is his home. They have his burial site is there, also his tailor shop and his home. And so there's a lot of tribute to him there in his hometown of Greenville, Tennessee.
One of the most memorable things I did in northeastern Tennessee was go to Bristol Motor Speedway, where the gladiators still live.
Listen, Bristol Motor Speedway is one of the top, of course, NASCAR speedways in the country. The night race is one of the most popular sporting events in the country. It's one of the largest, you know, coliseums, if you will, in the country. They just keep getting bigger and better. They've just put in this largest screen called Colossus that's hanging there in the middle. I don't even know how they did it. Don't want to know, but it's incredible there at Bristol Motor Speedway.
Kimberly Leonard.
Kimberly, what a treat. I have never been to Bristol or the area.
Bristol is actually located on the state lines of Tennessee and Virginia. We're home of the Bristol Motor Speedway, which is the world's fastest half-mile track, and we're also the birthplace of country music.
Here in the background is somebody doing hot laps at the raceway.
That's correct. And they're in the pace car and taking some laps around to get a feel for it.
My name is Lori Worley. I am the Director of Communications at the Bristol Chamber of Commerce and CVB.
Here we are at the Bristol Motor Speedway. Pretty cool.
You don't really expect to see a place that holds 160,000 fans sitting in the middle of Bristol. It's one of the largest facilities in the country, actually in the world, with seating-wise, so it's pretty cool. It looks a little bit like the Roman Colosseum.
And I hear this personality dimension here where people tend to act like gladiators more than other places.
When you have 43 cars on a half-mile track, and it's as steeply banked as this, and they're going as fast as they are, there's a lot of tempers. So we've had quite a few helmet throws and cars running into each other on purpose, and then afterward, words being said. So, yeah, there are a lot of fights here.
Definitely gladiator-dom of these car world.
Exactly, yeah. It's like no other. And it's the fans' favorite. It gets voted every single year by the fans as the place I want to come and watch a race.
What would be a primary reason why? What throws them over the top?
I think if you're a NASCAR fan, you've heard about Bristol for so many years. There are people who've been coming here since 1961, I mean, since it opened. Everybody knows that here, you're going to see racing that you don't see anyplace else. There's not a lot of room there. They race 3 wide. There's always going to be some beating and banging, and fans really like to see that. The night race is the most popular race in the sport because it's held at night. You can see a lot of when they bottom out, you see sparks. And fans like the fact that this is like a throwback in some ways to the old days because it is a lot of beating and banging with the cars. So, and they'll tell you they have fans that come here from all 50 states and 12 countries. So very popular place.
Wow, interesting. Somebody was saying saying that the lap is like 14 seconds or something like
right.
that.
Right, yeah, they qualify here in under 14 seconds, so that's pretty quick. 500 laps go by pretty fast here, unlike at a bigger track, but there's a lot of cautions too because there's a lot of incidents on the track. I've actually ridden around here back in the day with Dale Earnhardt Sr. The G-forces you feel here with that banking, it's just unreal and you can't even imagine. I think I went 8 or 10 laps and they do 500. So the drivers, anybody that says they are not athletes, they don't really know what they're talking about, I don't think.
World's fastest half mile. Half mile is a half mile. So how does it get to be so fast?
It's the banking in truth. When this track was built in 61, it was almost flat. And then in 1968, they decided to tear it up and add banking to it, which to this day, the king, Richard Petty, he always said, I won races when it was flat. But when they put all that banking in there, he didn't like it so much. But the banking is actually what gives you all the speed. They started calling it the world's fastest half mile probably back in the 60s. So it's always had that title. It is pretty darn quick. You had a lap around it, so it's pretty darn fast.
One more dimension that I find utterly fascinating, and that has to do with, again, your fans, and that there's only, 1,000 motel rooms in town, and you're bringing in 160,000 people, and they're campers. Tell us about that world. That's incredible.
Yeah, actually, in the area, in this immediate area, there's probably about 7,000 hotel rooms. In the Bristol area, there's not a lot, but in the immediate area, you could say 7,000. But when you've got 160,000 fans in here, most of them camp here, and there's about 60% that actually camp, and there are campgrounds all around. There's one here on the property, and then there's several all around here. So they come in, and believe it or not, especially in August, they'll come in 3 weeks in advance of the race. They will put their campers in place, and then they'll go travel up and down all through to Tennessee, you know, and, and see what's going on every other place. But there's nothing like race fans. They're a very dedicated and loyal group. They travel. They'll get in those campers, and a lot of them go to multiple races. So, yeah, the campers, it's something. It's like another city here when the races are here.
Right now we're in the center of the oval racetrack, but earlier we were at the drag strip. That's a very different world.
It is. It's actually a drag strip that was cut through the valley when it was built in 1965. It has since been revamped when Bruton Smith bought the track. He redid it in 1997. Holds about 20,000 fans over there, and if you've ever been to an NHRA drag race, you still need to come to Bristol because this is different in that the sound, because you are in a valley, is completely different. And when you see, you know, top fuel dragsters going 320 or 30 miles an hour and it's under 4 seconds, it's really nothing like it. And there's a lot of crossover, but some race fans who are simply drag fans and some who are NASCAR fans, and they don't like to, they like going straight. Those guys like going straight. Huh. These guys like turning.
They don't cross-pollinate.
Yeah, not a lot of it. Not really. I think there's still some that do, but I mean, for the most part, the guys like going straight, like I said, and the other guys that turn left all the time, the fans, they really like that. So you need to get in a car and go for a pace lap.
Yeah, I can do that. If somebody wanted to learn more information about Bristol,
all you have to do is go to the website, bristolmotorspeedway.com. You can find out anything you want to know there. My name is Lori Worley. I am the Director of Communications at the Bristol Chamber of Commerce and CVB.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, another thing I was going to share about Bristol is that we opened the Birthplace of Country Music Museum there. And that is back to the Bristol Sessions that were recorded in 1927 and launched the careers of the great Carter family and Jimmy Rogers, and really put country music, that was the foundation that began to cause the rise of the most popular genre of music in America, country music.
My name is Jessica Turner. I'm the director and head curator of the Birthplace of Country Music Museum in Bristol. This museum represents Bristol's regional history in Appalachian music, but especially the Bristol Sessions of 1927 and 1928. So those were Ralph Peer's recordings for the Victor Talking Machine Company, where the Carter family first recorded, Jimmy Rogers first recorded, also Ernest Stoneman, not his first recording. So why we call ourselves the birthplace of country music when there's music going far back from that, as early as 1924, when Vernon Dalhart first records The Wreck of the Old 97, or Ernest Stoneman first records The Titanic. You know, those first recordings happen in New York, and they happen in Atlanta, and they happen in Camden, New Jersey. So those are, you know, arguably the real birthplaces of country music. Bristol is significant because these were the first commercially successful records. Vernon Dalhart was very successful, but this was really the recognition of, oh my goodness, what a beautiful genre, and the business of the record industry realizing that this is a highly marketable style of music. These hillbilly records, they were called. So marketed as hillbilly records by Ralph Peer with Victor, also by Columbia Records and OK Records, who were all doing their recordings there.
Back in the 20s and 30s, did this become a Nashville of sorts? Was it to draw for people to come to record?
I think Bristol was an anomaly. I mean, what we have in Bristol in the 1920s is a cosmopolitan urban center in Appalachia, and that's why the Bristol Sessions happened here. Ralph Peer came here because he could easily get here on the railway. He came down from New York at the recommendation of Ernest Stoneman, who said, you know, Bristol, there's a lot of music in that region, and Bristol would be a great place to bring these musicians to come and record. And so that's why Ralph Peer came to Bristol for one of these first field recording sessions. And then after Bristol, it was so successful, Columbia went to Johnson City and did their own recording sessions there. And there were recording sessions in Winston-Salem and in Savannah, Georgia, and in Asheville. So after Bristol, the recording industry is traveling to a lot of other cities. And so Bristol is significant because it's one of those places that certain stars like the Carter Family and Jimmy Rogers were discovered or recorded here in Bristol. Also, the technology of the time made those Bristol Sessions records a little crisper than the earlier recordings because of the Western Electric microphone. And it just built over time. And what we're doing in the museum is talking about those early recordings, the Carters, Jimmy Rogers, recording technology and sound technology, and also the business of hillbilly records. So what did Ralph Peer do as a businessman? The copyright system that we use today can be credited back to Ralph Peer, that three-part system where the lyrics are copyrighted, the performance is copyrighted, and the music arrangement is copyrighted, comes out of that early music industry.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. For further information, you can contact the Birthplace of Country Music at 423-573-1927. My email address is jturner@birthplaceofcountrymusic.org.
Website?
Birthplaceofcountrymusic.org.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
For Tennessee there in Bristol, that was the most popular, and that's what, again, catapulted the music that way, was those recording sessions from 1927.
If anybody's known an old-time Tennessean, they know they love to talk and tell story. And it seems that this is the headquarters of America for storytelling, and you have a place where you can go. You can get a master's degree in the art of storytelling in Tennessee. Tell us about that. That's so cool.
You know, you're right about storytelling. People in Tennessee, people all over the South, we pride ourselves in our ability to tell a great story. So the International Storytelling Center is there in Jonesboro. That's our oldest incorporated town in Tennessee, and talking about history going back into the 1700s, that town was founded. And then just about 25, 30 years ago, they launched the International Storytelling Festival, and it really began to cause this germ of an idea of really formalizing storytelling and getting it back on the map in that way, and causing it to be one of the most popular events in the country. Thousands of people come there now for that festival, and out of that was built the Storytelling Center, and they have tellers, they call them, come every summer for the entire summer there in Jonesboro and the northeastern part of the state. So it's a very special part of who we are and what we offer to travelers who come here.
And it still blows my mind that you literally can get a master's degree in the art of storytelling.
Up there at East Tennessee State.
That's for real.
That's for real. And you know what else you might not know, but that's the only place in the country that you can actually major in old-time string band music and also get a degree in bluegrass music. So that East Tennessee State University is also one of the famous alumni there is Kenny Chesney, one of the most popular country music artists in the world. But that university, they are visionary people about Southern culture and making sure that we do not lose these great arts of our culture here in the South.
My name is Alicia Phelps. I'm the Director of Tourism and Marketing for the town of Jonesboro, Tennessee.
There are two things about Jonesboro that are unique claims in America.
Absolutely. Jonesboro is the oldest town in Tennessee, and we were settled in 1779, so we do have a lot of historical, awesome things going on in Jonesboro, and we're also known as the storytelling capital of the world. We have storytellers from all over the world come to Jonesboro. One of the neat things is our National Storytelling Festival. That's in October. Folks come from all over the world to check it out, and it's kind of like the mecca of storytelling. It's an honor to be at the festival and to be a teller and to be selected to come to the festival.
That's so cool. Right now, nobody can see us, but we're on the stage.
That's right.
At the International Storytelling Center in Jonesboro. Is this the primary venue where the storytellers would perform?
We are at the International Storytelling Center, so this would be the heart. It's located right in the middle of the historic downtown district, which speaks for itself when you see Jonesboro's charm and history, just breathtaking when you can see it when you enter Jonesboro. But there are venues all over Jonesboro and within the region of Northeast Tennessee. Like I was saying earlier, Appalachian Tales, those mountain tales, that's where a lot of the storytelling originated, and we're really proud of that. I feel like everybody in Jonesboro is a storyteller, and when you come to Jonesboro, you know, you get to leave with it too. Mm-hmm. You get a story to tell too. So there's a lot of venues in Jonesboro with different events going on, telling stories, things like that.
As we both know, storytelling is a worldwide tradition, but even though there's storytellers in Maine or Washington, D.C. or New York or California, you guys have a corner on it in the South, don't you?
We do. You know, like you said, there's a lot of larger festivals devoted to storytelling. There's even an international day of storytelling where tellers tell tales on the same day at the same time. It's a tradition that's passed on, and I think it's growing, and it was almost a lost art for a while. But yes, Jonesboro is the center. We take that storytelling capital of the world with heart, and we boast that proudly because it's just something that we love to share and embrace, and it has a lot to do with our culture and our heritage, and that's something that makes people really excited.
Mm-hmm. Not all your performers are from the South.
They are not. And that's one of the neat things with the Teller in Residence program here at the International Storytelling Center. That's May through October, Tuesday through Saturday. Folks come in and they can experience these tales. One thing about storytelling is, yes, we like the mountain tales and the folklore and things like that, but storytelling is sharing your story. It's sharing your experience, sharing your culture. And so that's where we get folks from all over the world to come in and share that. And then you and I heard a story tonight. We're probably going to go tell somebody about it. Probably going to go tell them about the Boston Red Sox and about the crabs in Maine and the clam chowders. We're passing on stories, and that's what we like to do here in Jonesboro.
Do you have a connection with Eastern Tennessee State University and their master's program in story?
That's right. Our local university here in Johnson City, Tennessee, East Tennessee State University, has a master's in storytelling, an undergrad degree in storytelling. They also touch in a little bit with the bluegrass. Music tells stories, and bluegrass, old-time music that tells stories. But we have a heavy influence with them. We work great together, keeping this art alive, developing new tellers, ways to tell these stories. Don't turn your cell phone off when you're in a performance. Put it on silent, take pictures, record it, share these stories, get it going through social media. So that's one of the cool things, is to have that resource for us, and we work hand in hand together and along with the community too.
Your itinerary, you go May to November?
They go May through October here at the International Storytelling Center with tellers from around the world. Now in Jonesboro, we have the Jonesboro Storytellers Guild, a night with the Jonesboro Yarn Exchange, which is a radio-based story program.
Tell us about that for a moment. Radio-based statewide?
It is radio-based with actually ETSU, W. WGTS 89.5 FM. They have the Radio Hour here live at the International Storytelling Center once a month. And that consists of stories about the region and stories that have been collected by folks. They don't really want to get on stage and tell their story, but they've told a story that maybe didn't know it. Mm-hmm. So we have folks out there collecting those stories, and they're developed into a production, a play, or a musical about these stories. And people come in and they sit live in this audience. Mm-hmm. And so WETS with ETSU, they record those, and then it's broadcast live on their radio waves every fourth Wednesday of the month, and that's how it gets spread out in the world. So
that's nice. If I wanted to come here, I'm a storyteller, and if I wanted to be tutored and hone my craft, what could I do here?
There are many opportunities to get involved in storytelling. Of course, the source here is at the International Storytelling Center.
You have classes here?
Yes, they can do classes, workshops, even children's programs, because, you know, it really does start at a young age, and when you hear storytelling, you think fairy tales.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, with ETSU, their program there, East Tennessee State University, that's a great resource for workshops and things like that. One of the neat things about the National Storytelling Festival is you can go in a sound booth, tell your story, record it, and then you get to go back and listen to it. They have amateur storytelling competition, story slam, different things like that going on. We don't want to keep our traditions of storytelling to ourselves. We want to share it with the world. So that's one of the great ways to do that.
That's so cool.
We would love for everybody just to come visit us. You know, we're storytelling history, locally owned mom and pop shops. That's what our downtown is about. So it's a really great place to kick back, go back to yesteryear. We're nestled right here in the Appalachian Mountains in Northeast Tennessee. So
for further information,
all the fun things there is to do, places to stay, and storytelling, of course, and history, you can visit us at historicjonesboro.com or call our lovely ladies at the Historic Jonesboro Visitor Center in Old Town Emporium at 423-753-1010, and we'll get you set up. We also had the experience of just an awesome teller tonight, Michael Parent. He is from Maine. He's been all over the world sharing the art of storytelling and telling some of the neat tales that he told us tonight, from folk stories to just growing up stories and fun stories about the Red Sox. He has also been a featured teller at the National Storytelling Festival. We talked about that, how it's just an honor to be there and share that. He's also a Storytelling Circle of Excellence Award winner.
Michael, hi, welcome.
Hi, Tom, how are you?
I'm great. French-Canadian roots, correct?
Yes, both my parents are from Quebec.
Okay, because we were talking about the Southern tradition of storytelling
Yes.
in America, and you bring a new and different angle to that tradition here.
I would say so, because I lived in Virginia for a while, but I never quite felt at home there in the same way that I'd feel at home in Maine. It was fine. I loved Charlottesville, Virginia, where I lived, but when I went back to Maine, I felt like, okay, now I'm home.
I'm familiar with the Irish tradition of the roots of storytelling coming to Canada Northeast, but I'm not aware, I know nothing about the French tradition. Can you talk about that, of how it came across the pond?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. There was a man named Marius Barbeau, and he was a great collector and folklorist, and he went all over Canada maybe 80 years ago with a huge recording machine. Now we have these simple little ones that, like you're using now. And he collected hundreds upon hundreds of stories and songs, and those are all available. And so what happened was, I think, and this is just a theory, that these stories came from France, they came to Canada. A lot of the older people knew them, and they told them all the time, because there was no TV, there was no radio in a lot of these houses in Quebec in the early days, maybe at the turn of the century, of the 20th century. So I think that what happened was, those stories went from France to Quebec to parts of New England. They tried to retain their culture, but I think it would be accurate to say that the culture has been maintained more in song than in story. And I'm probably one of the few people who's still telling these old French-Canadian folktales, like the one you heard tonight, The String of Trout, has been around for a long, long time, but I'm probably the only person who tells it, or somebody who... In storytelling, you are exactly focused on the audience, no matter how large it is.
It's one-on-one, isn't it? Even though it's a group of people, yes.
Yeah. At this festival, at the National Festival, they have tents where you can put, I don't know, 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're one of those 1,000 people, it feels like that person on stage, especially since they have really good sound systems,
mm-hmm.
it feels like the person is telling you
yes.
the story.
And conversely, you as the presenter, you look out and you see individual eyes looking at you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it really, to me, it's not so much the numbers as the focus or
yes.
the level of attention.
Yep. Michael Parent, I wish we could go on. I'm going to have to let you go because I know there are people waiting for you. Yeah. You have to go do a performance. But for now,
okay, thank
bonsoir.
You, Tom. Bonsoir. Merci beaucoup.
We've been speaking with Michael Parent, the teller in residence. Let's jump back. I want to learn more about Knoxville, a place I've never been to, but I keep hearing more and more cool things. Oh my gosh, you've got to go to Knoxville. Why?
Well, Tom, first of all, I agree completely. You personally need to come to Knoxville. We need to make that work out. But also, for our people who are interested in coming to the state, we just did a campaign, Why Knox? Why should you come to Knoxville? And there are many, many reasons, and I'll try to cover a few of them. First of all, it's a great college town. The University of Tennessee is there. So anytime you go to a college town, I think there's an energy and a vibrancy and a contemporary atmosphere that is very appealing. There's a great culture there of history because it was our original capital of the state. So they have more historic homes open year-round than Charleston, South Carolina. Wow. So there's a lot of great history there in terms of the historic homes and the house tours that you can visit there. But there's this great night scene as well in what they call the Old City in Knoxville. It's right on the Tennessee River, so there's riverboat cruises that you can take. And also they have this very special place called Market Square that is shopping and dining and really great culinary there in Knoxville. And then they have our state theater, the Tennessee Theater. So the culture, the arts, the culinary, and then the great nightlife and great adventures. They are also have been called the Boulder of the South because they are right in the foothills of Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and they have really built robust outdoor experience there of biking and hiking and paddleboarding and all kinds of things. So it's a great place.
It's amazing the number of young people I have met across the country that are moving there or want to move there. So there has to be an economic underpinning that's driving that economy, that's making it happen.
I agree with that. I think the economy here in Tennessee is strong. The job market is robust. I feel like in Knoxville and really across the state, one of the appealing things about moving to Tennessee is there is no state income tax, and that's very appealing to people. They love to move here. A lot of people like to retire here for that reason. So the housing market is very affordable in terms of getting housing in Tennessee compared to a lot of other states. So I do feel like that's a part of why people want to move here.
Back to nature, the Great Smoky Mountains and that whole experience is a reason that a lot of people come to Tennessee.
That's another thing that I would like to share with people is the quality of life in Tennessee. Certainly, as we discussed, the economy is great, but also the scenic beauty. We are sitting here in nature at the Red Clay State Park here in Cleveland, Tennessee. This was the last council of the Native American tribe, the Cherokee. So this is a beautiful scenic beauty here right in this very small town in Tennessee. But also across the state, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park is the most visited national park in the country, and it is so beautiful all seasons, but especially in the fall. They have one of the most glorious fall landscapes in the entire country.
Does the Blue Ridge Trail come through here?
The Blue Ridge does not. The Appalachian Trail does come through Tennessee and through the Smoky Mountains, and of course that's a very popular thing for people to experience. Even if you just do part of it, it's a wonderful experience.
So we started out this morning in Chattanooga, and as you know, I'm a sucker for big band music, Glenn Miller and Dorsey and whatnot. And I did not know that the Chattanooga Choo Choo was birthed here and was a game changer in American music.
You know what? That song, the Chattanooga Choo Choo, has been recorded by so many people. But it was recorded first by the great Glenn Miller and his orchestra. And actually, 75 years ago, this past May, that song was recorded. It became number one in the country on December 7th, 1941. So 75 years ago, that song became the number one song in the country. And then it became the very first gold record ever given to an artist for over a million selling record. So Glenn Miller received that award in February of 1942. And that song helped put Chattanooga and Tennessee on the map. And it continues to be a popular song. It's been recorded by so many people we couldn't even name them all, but it is well known by people around the world, and again, it puts the spotlight on this great town in southeast Tennessee, Chattanooga.
I understand there's a hotel in downtown Chattanooga called the Choo Choo.
There's a great hotel, and it's actually in the old Union Station that they refurbished and renovated as a hotel called the Chattanooga Choo Choo. They have great dining there, great nightlife, and certainly one of the special things is that they have actual train cars that you can stay in that have been renovated into hotel rooms. So it's a very special place, and continue the legacy of Glenn Miller. They have just named their beautiful rose garden, the Glenn Miller Gardens. So that's a very special part of what's happening in this 75th anniversary.
A little backstory, how did the song come about?
You know what? The song was written by Mack Gordon and Harry Warner, and certainly when Glenn Miller recorded it, he was up in New York and recorded it. He did not record it here, but you know, it was birthed because of the train that ran here and stopped at that very Union Station there in Chattanooga. And it was, if you listen to the song, there's a sense of what was happening in the military and the troops coming home and all that are leaving, and so very much a part of that war era that is in the hearts of Americans, and I think that's why that song has had such a great vibrancy over the years.
Cindy Dupree, what a pleasure to see you again and visit in paradise.
Yes, paradise it is, and everybody needs to come to Tennessee. Thank you for coming, and we look forward to all of you listening, giving us a visit as soon as you can. Please come and see us in Tennessee.
Cindy Dupree, what a pleasure.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Tennessee. We'll see you there.
The intro and segue underbid music was performed by five-time Grammy Award-winning musician from North Carolina, David Holt. The bluegrass underbed music and outro was recorded live at the Dunlap Coke Ovens Bluegrass Festival 2016 in Dunlap, Tennessee. The original 1927 Bristol Sessions music cuts were provided courtesy of the Birthplace of Country Music Museum in Bristol, Tennessee.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's TV and film podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdell, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez. Melissa Corbin reporting from Knoxville, Tennessee, Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Steve Cook contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.
From Northern Hamilton County, Miss Tiffany Rogers. And he drove all the way down here from about a half mile above town, Mr. Billy Gaston. It's nice to have you with us. We're going to do you an old-time number called the Fireball Bell. I want to say Farewell Bell.